This is Only a Game. I'm Karen Given. American pro Sarah Hall will be among the elite runners in Monday's Boston Marathon. You might remember that Sarah and her husband Ryan, who holds the record for the fastest time run by an American on the Boston Marathon course, joined our show back in 2016. At the time, Ryan had just retired from competitive running, and Sarah was moving up to the marathon distance. While together, they had agreed to start a family.
There's no doubt being a parent is a sacrifice, and adopting four kids was not a performance-enhancing decision.
Since becoming a mom, Sarah's running has continued to thrive, but she's not the only competitive runner thriving under the Hall family roof. Reporter Amory Rowe brings us this story.
If you were born and raised in Ethiopia, you would know the ring of a track race's bell lap, the way an American child recognizes the crack of a baseball hitting a wooden bat. It's a sound full of possibility.
Coming up to the bell, and Dibaba is going away from this field. Even the likes of Cheruiyot and Kipyegon may have to yield to Dibaba. She looks so strong.
When your country has won 54 Olympic distance running medals, and someone asks you what you want to be when you grow up, oftentimes the answer isn't much of a surprise.
The first time I saw on television was Turunesh Dibaba, and I was like, oh my gosh, I really want to be like her.
That's Hannah Hall, the oldest of four sisters adopted by Ryan and Sarah Hall 3.5 years ago. Hannah's dream of being an Olympic runner was nothing out of the ordinary for a girl growing up in Ethiopia, but everything else about her circumstances was. Ryan Hall explains.
They were in a great orphanage with great nannies, like well taken care of, had everything they need. But at the same time, like they never left the orphanage. So their physical activity for the day was literally playing in a driveway. And so, you know, they had soccer balls and different kind of things they could do, but it was very limited. And, you know, they weren't feeling the dirt under their feet or the grass under their feet.
Hannah and her sisters, Mia, Jasmine, and Lily, had been in the orphanage for 3 years when the Halls began a conversation about adopting them.
They're having a hard time finding a family for the girls, and they were talking about possibly splitting the girls up, and so sending two to one family, two to another family. And that just really gripped my heart because I grew up in the middle of five kids, and I just know like how important my siblings are to me, and I just could not imagine being separated from my siblings at that age.
Ryan and Sarah started visiting the orphanage regularly. Because of the language barrier, they couldn't talk much, and Hannah and her sisters knew little of Ryan and Sarah's life back home.
We would kind of spend every other month in Ethiopia, which was actually really fun to train there.
That's Sarah.
And then we would head to the orphanage, and we would do some physical activity stuff with them.
They were not what we had observed as typical, you know, Ethiopian children who are typically very fit, very active, always walking. Whereas, you know, our girls, after being in an orphanage and not moving a whole lot, had put on a lot of unhealthy weight, especially kind of our older two, just because they weren't able to be physically active. When we'd go visit, we'd try and do just fun games with them, physical games. I remember doing relays with them. I remember we'd do like planking, just trying to like do physical things that are fun for them, just to try to get them moving a little bit more.
Eventually, Sarah and Ryan sat down with the girls. A nurse asked them if they wanted to formalize the adoption and join Sarah and Ryan's family. It was important to the Halls that the girls were given a choice in the matter. Hannah and her sisters responded with an emphatic yes.
After we asked them if they wanted to join our family, we got permission to take them out of the orphanage, which didn't typically happen, and take them shopping for some clothes and stuff, because especially the older girls didn't have any clothes that fit them, because a lot of the donations were for babies. So we were mainly going shopping in Meskel Square, but seeing the runners training there in Meskel Square, the girls were excited to get out and join in. And so yeah, that was our first family run. The first day we decided to become a family, I guess.
Do you remember about how far you guys ran that day?
Oh, it was super short. It's probably like 200 meters, maybe. It was, yeah. The girls, we had to start out really, really slow with just getting them active again.
Later, while staying at the Yaya Village, a training facility outside of Addis Ababa, and awaiting visas for their daughters, the Halls brought the girls to the track.
It's actually dirt track. Yeah, we're just kind of like doing it for fun. But then I was like, I couldn't do it like two laps because I never done like running, you know. I was like, oh my gosh, this is really hard. Like, then I just like stopped in the middle and I was like cried. I was like, why is this so hard? Like, you know, but it was fun though.
Before the new family of six left Ethiopia, Sarah and Ryan asked a translator to spend some time with them.
Just to get to know the girls a little more, because they didn't speak any English and we were still learning Amharic. And we asked the girls like what they wanted to be when they grew up. And Hannah said a runner, and that kind of surprised us, but we were kind of like, okay, and we told her we were runners.
Sarah says they had told the girls a bit about their running careers earlier, but they didn't fully understand how famous their parents were until the family arrived in the States. The girls settled into their new home in Redding, California. Hannah and her sister Mia ran track for their middle school.
Their strides were not very pretty looking at the time, but they were tough. They still, like, did really well, just because I feel like they know how to push through pain and stuff, maybe in a different way.
Over time, Hannah's fitness caught up with her tenacity and her enduring childhood ambition to be a successful runner. And just 1 year after the family settled in California, when Hannah was in ninth grade, she towed the line at the Eureka Cross Country Showdown.
There's like a lot of people fit, so I was like, okay, I'll do my best. That's all I can do. And my mom and dad were there. I just like say encouraged me to go through, to just like push it, just do best.
Ryan recorded a video as the first runner approached the finish. It was Hannah. She held her advantage to the line, notching her first ever running victory.
Great run, Hannah. Good job. Nice, Hannah. Finish strong. Finish strong. Great job, Hannah.
I'm not a very emotional person. Like, I don't cry at movies. And I'm just not, like, super emotional.
Yeah.
But for whatever reason, like, that moment really, like it almost brought me to tears. I think people who are parents would understand the feeling, but when you're watching like your kids do something and you see them thriving at it, there's just something about that that just mm-hmm. pulls on your heart in a way that my heart had never been pulled on before.
Do you remember anything that your mom and dad said to you after that race?
Oh yeah, like they were like so excited. They were like, how you feel about doing the race? And like, you look really strong during the race. I was like, oh, I am. You know, it kind of like makes me really happy.
Ryan says Hannah began putting in consistent work 6 days a week. She ran in the early mornings and at team practices after school. She went for long runs on the weekend.
I mean, she does have an advantage in the fact that, like, I was essentially coaching her that entire time. So, mm-hmm. like, I know a few things about running that I think helped her.
Just a few.
Yeah. So, but man, just seeing the power of consistency.
She has that fire that you just can't teach, you know? Like, you can help someone gain fitness in running and become a stronger athlete, but you can't really teach that competitive drive and fire, and I could tell that she had that.
Last summer, the Hall family moved to Flagstaff, Arizona, and Hannah enrolled as a junior at Flagstaff High. A new state, a new town, and a new school brought new challenges, but it also brought a new team and a fresh cross-country season. Hannah wasted no time establishing herself as the number one runner on Flagstaff's roster. And this past fall, she entered the Arizona State High School Cross-Country Championships with a target on her back.
In the morning, I was really nervous. I was like, oh my gosh, there's like so many people in here. It's really crowded and it's really exciting. Yeah, and my parents were there and my grandparents were there. I was like, wow, that's so cool.
It was a little bit of a challenging day for me personally because I had, I think just the week before, run the Frankfurt Marathon and in the process injured my peroneal tendon pretty severely. So I was hobbling around. I was on crutches, but I didn't really want to be on crutches out there. So I was trying to like walk around without the crutches. But normally I run all around in her race and I'm able to cheer for her like 40 times, but I wasn't able to do that. But yeah, before the race, I just told her like, just go out there and be you. You know, you don't have to be superhuman today. You don't have to like do anything that you don't already do every day. Like every day you go out and bring it. If you do that, you're going to win this race. And so I just tried to help kind of bring the nerves down. And I think what's fun is, like, as an athlete, I know what I want my coach to tell me that's going to put me at ease, make me feel confident, you know? Right. And so it's fun to get to have that translate to Hannah.
With Sarah confined to the finish area, it was up to Ryan to be Hannah's support during the race. He told Hannah he'd be at the 2-mile mark, the most quiet part of the course, where she was planning to break the race open.
I found that, like, that's always a really good place to make a move, is where there's no one else,
because
there's not a lot of energy out there. And so a lot of people, they kind of relax in those areas of the course. So I told her I'd be there, but the problem is I had been, like, sprinting all over the course to try to cheer for her before that point. And so I popped out at that point, and she was already, like, 100 meters past me. So I was literally, like, sprinting down this golf course, like, in my jeans and, like, a V-neck t-shirt, trying to catch up to her, and, like, don't have any air in my lungs, but somehow, like, managed to yell at her, like, go on now.
He just, like, shout, like, so loud and, like, okay, you got this, like, you almost there. Like, I was like, okay, you know, like, I was pretty, like, tired and stuff, and then I was like, okay, my dad's here, like, cheering me on, and, like, I can do this, I can finish this. Yeah, that was really inspiring.
Hannah broke the finishing tape of the challenging 5-kilometer course in 18 minutes and 7 seconds. She became the third member of the Hall family to be crowned high school state cross-country champion, though you could argue she'd traveled the farthest to do so.
Her story speaks to me all the time. I mean, honestly, I don't know how she does what she does every day. Like, you know, she's been dealt, like, such a rough hand. Like, even of the four of our kids, like, definitely the hardest hand, being the oldest and never going to school, starting school at 15, was the least fit of all of them, and yet has just defined what it is to be an overcomer, you know?
It's hard not to think about how far Hannah has come. 9,000 miles from Ethiopia, 4 schools in 4 years, a new language. And while she's covered all that distance, she's stayed true to her childhood dream. Except now, it's not Tirunesh Dibaba she's chasing. She's chosen new role models.
Yeah, I kind of want to be really good professionals like my mom and dad, so that's my goal.
Hannah Hall will be cheering for her mom, Sarah Hall, in the Boston Marathon on Monday. Our story came from reporter Amory Rowe. You're listening to Only a Game from NPR.
This podcast is made possible by Samuel Adams. For 34 years, Samuel Adams has made their Boston Lager inefficiently. Sam Adams brews with 100% heirloom Mittelfrüh hops, lagering their beer for over a month. The Boston Beer Company, Boston, Mass. Savor the flavor responsibly.
Hey, it's Ophira Eisenberg, host of NPR's Ask Me Another, and I'm here to let you know that every Friday in April, we're bringing you an episode that spotlights women in comedy. You'll hear from Retta, the star of NBC's Parks and Recreation, and I'll talk to Russian Doll actor Greta Lee and co-creator Leslie Headland, and many more. Listen now.
I'm Karen Given, and it's time for 3 stories you should know. This week, we've got 3 basketball stories from 3 different leagues. I'm joined by The Wall Street Journal's Rachel Bachman and The Athletic's Michael Lee. Welcome back to both of you.
Great to be here, Karen.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Michael, start us off in the NBA.
Well, the NBA playoffs are upon us, but before we get ready for what is expected to be a 2-month coronation for the Golden State Warriors, we should probably look back on what just happened. Not just the regular season coming to an end, but the careers of 2 legends and short-time rivals, Dwayne Wade and Dirk Nowitzki. Wade announced before the season that this would be his final dance, leaving it up to fans and opposing players to serenade him with 6 months of fawning affection. Nowitzki wasn't sure that he'd call it quits until the season's final weeks, but before the truth hit him, fans, coaches, and even Commissioner Adam Silver noticed how terribly he was moving and enthusiastically said goodbye before he snuck off. Recent farewells for Kobe Bryant and Tim Duncan have aligned perfectly with their personalities. Wade, of course, invited the goodbyes. If it were up to him, Nowitzki probably would have walked away the way Duncan did, with no fanfare or public displays of emotion. But in a social media age that has signaled our heightened desire for nostalgia and connection, will a truly great player ever get a chance to just fade into the background? Or should he just appreciate the love fest?
Well, I think he should appreciate it. I mean, who among us gets this kind of adulation? It's incredible, on and on and on. I have to say the NBA gets social media better than any other league in the world. They have the TV show Atlanta refers to as a no chase policy when it comes to putting clips on Twitter. You know, in other words, any fan can rip off a few seconds and put it online. The NBA lets this happen. And I think it's so smart to cultivate this, you know, never ending social media love fest for the NBA. It's just very savvy.
Absolutely. I would like to cede a little of my time to number 44.
D. Wade, congratulations on a great run. Now, I know what you're going through, because saying goodbye to a career that you love is never easy. I've been there. In my case, though, I didn't really have a choice. You know, my knees were shot, so I had to give up basketball forever.
I just wanted to hear his voice again. But I do actually have a point. And that is, I think that it's true. Social media does play into this, and there are nostalgia and good feelings. But I really feel like we are enjoying these moments because there's very little else to enjoy. I don't know how to say it, right? Like, we are enjoying this retirement moment, I think, a little bit more than we used to, just because it's really great to have something that we can all get behind and enjoy right now.
Oh, I totally agree. And I think that if you're a fan of, say, the Mavericks or the Heat, who both missed out on the playoffs, then all you really could just focus on is the fact that you were fortunate enough to have a legend play for your team and bring championships to your city.
All right. Well, the WNBA has a new logo. For those keeping track at home, this is the second new logo in 6 years for the league. The new logo wears her hair in a bun instead of a ponytail, and she's not contained inside a box, which is nice. I actually have no issues with the new logo at all, except for this one. The WNBA is 22 years old. 2018 was an exciting and successful season on the court, but it was still all but ignored by many in the mainstream media. The players have opted out of the CBA, signaling what's likely to be a contentious contract negotiation. Is a new logo really what the league needs right now?
You know, that's a good question. I think you could always debate whether change is the right thing when a league is still growing its base. And I think the jury's really still out. One thing that I think the WNBA could still do is in some way try to capitalize more on the momentum and the growing interest in the women's Final Four and the women's tournament. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a challenge. As we all know, women's pro leagues are way behind just in terms of timing. Most men's leagues have half a century, if not more, of a head start. And in a very crowded attention economy, that's quite an obstacle to overcome.
Michael, what do you think?
Well, actually, I love the logo, primarily because it breaks away from the NBA and just it sort of was seen as sort of a spinoff as opposed to its own entity. And I love what the league is doing now in terms of having its players become more voices in, say, men's games and seeing Candace Parker doing TNT or the NCAA tournament. I think having women's voices and understanding that the game itself of basketball is just something we should embrace, not just as a man or a woman, just as just great basketball players. And I think if you talk to NBA players, which I do, they have the utmost respect for WNBA players because they know how hard it is, and they also respect and admire the fact that these women can hoop. Anybody who knows ball, and they can respect it. And I think that just seeing women more out, you know, and we can understand that they have a knowledge of the game and we can appreciate it more, it's going to bring in more fans that can understand that this is the game of basketball. You know, it's beautiful no matter who's playing.
And finally, we're going to move on to college basketball. Rachel, what's going on?
Well, Texas Tech became one of the more surprising teams in the NCAA men's final in recent history for a couple of reasons. But a big one was because of transfers. Two of their starters were graduate transfers. That means they graduated from their previous schools. This was great. I mean, you know, you don't often see first-time champions. I think this was Virginia, for instance, was the first-time champion since 2006. Usually it's the same blue bloods over and over again. So it was really fun to see some new teams. Of course, in comes the NCAA to change the rule or propose changing the rule. They will soon vote on a proposal to essentially discourage schools or make it more difficult for schools to accept graduate transfers if certain conditions aren't met. Of course, coaches like to keep control. They like to know that their players are going to be around and not be transferring or, for instance, leaving early for the NBA. So some of them would like to see less movement. But, you know, I think this is fantastic. I mean, a lot of times, as we all know, college doesn't go exactly as planned. Situations change and you have a chance to go to this rising team. And by the way, you already have your degree. So I don't see much downside to the way things are right now and a lot of upside.
When the NCAA does something right, let me know, because I'm still waiting for them to make a decision that makes sense. Like you said, you know, sometimes some situations just don't work out. And sometimes you have a situation where, you know, you just want to be closer to home. Any other student has a right to do that. And if a coach can leave without any, you know, no punishment is involved there, then I don't know why the players have to be the ones to suffer when they are what people come to see.
I don't know why the NCAA makes it so easy for us to criticize them, right? Consider this. Abilene Christian University made their first appearance in March Madness this year. That school only graduates 29% of its Black basketball players. Abilene Christian isn't being told to improve that statistic or risk punishment. So how can we believe the people in the NCAA who are suggesting that this graduate student issue is a matter of integrity? It's absolutely ridiculous to me. What they're saying is, if you don't graduate within a year, the school is going to be punished. There are a lot of graduate degrees that take more than a year. Mine took five, but I was really slow.
And it might take longer if you're playing basketball, for
Absolutely.
Instance.
Exactly.
Rachel, I think you're right. This is all about control. And it's just another way for the coaches to control their players for as long as possible. Am I really being too harsh on that?
No, I don't think so. And you know, let's take a step back and remember that the NCAA is not just like five bureaucrats in a room in Indianapolis. It is a member-led organization. So very often when these proposals that are often unpopular get elevated, it's because a bunch of schools said, we don't want this to happen or we want this to happen. So the NCAA, to some extent, is doing the bidding of the schools that make up its organization.
My guests for this week's basketball edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been The Wall Street Journal's Rachel Bachman and The Athletic's Michael Lee. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you, Karen.
Hey, thank you very much.
When Ernie Banks was inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame in 1977, he started his acceptance speech like this.
We got the setting, sunshine, fresh air. We got the team behind us. So let's play two.
Let's Play Two is the title of a new biography about Ernie Banks, written by Ron Rappaport. Banks played 19 seasons for the Chicago Cubs, earning 14 All-Star nods, but there was a side of him few people knew. In the prologue to his book, Rappaport tells the story of one moment when Ernie Banks let down his guard. And we liked that story so much, we decided to give it a double play. That's what we call our occasional series, where we turn a newspaper column or book chapter into a radio drama.
On the morning of September 11th, 2001, former Illinois State Senator William Maravitz was awakened in a hotel room in Omaha, Nebraska, by the sound of a ringing telephone.
Turn on the TV,
the voice in his ear said.
It's early,
Maravitz said.
Turn it on.
Together, they watched smoke billowing from the North Tower of the World Trade Center in New York and the chaos in the streets below.
Oh, my God.
Then they gasped in unison as a second plane struck the South Tower.
So this looks like it is some sort of a concerted effort to attack the World Trade Center.
Maravitz hurriedly dressed and took a cab to the golf course not far away. There, he joined more than 100 others who had been invited to attend an outing arranged by Warren Buffett, the businessman, investor, and philanthropist, and one of the world's richest men.
For the first time in my life, I'm speechless,
But those who had flown to Omaha should entertain no thoughts of returning home anytime soon, Buffett warned.
I know many of you have your own planes, but it doesn't matter. The sky is closed.
Meravitz looked around for the two men he had previously arranged to play with. Stedman Graham, a Chicago businessman who is best known as the fiancé of Oprah Winfrey, and Ernie Banks, the Hall of Fame baseball player who had spent his entire career with the Chicago Cubs. As they made their way around the golf course, they could see Buffett visiting with each group of golfers and giving them updates on the attacks. As he approached them, Buffett's walkie-talkie crackled.
Mr. Buffett, Air Force One has just landed in Omaha.
The plane carrying President George W. Bush had arrived at nearby Offutt Air Force Base, the headquarters of the United States Strategic Command, which contained an underground bunker built to withstand a nuclear blast.
At that point, we don't know if we're in the safest place in the world or the most dangerous.
At breakfast the next morning, Graham told Meravitz and Banks that Winfrey would be sending a plane. But as the day wore on, it became clear that not even Oprah Winfrey would be able to breach the closure of the nation's air traffic. And for two more days, Buffett's out-of-town visitors remained stranded. On the third day, Meravitz began making calls and found a rental agency that had a car available. He invited his golfing companions to join him, but Graham held firm. He would wait for Winfrey's plane, he said. But Banks said,
I'm coming with you.
And after getting directions from the hotel, the two men set off on a trip to Chicago they were told would take about 7 hours. Despite Banks's constant public display of good cheer, Meravitz and others who knew him well were aware of another, more complicated side of his personality. Upon meeting people, Banks would always ask a question and then follow up with more. Only later would those talking to him realize that he had not said a single word about himself.
He'd ask me,
how's that new restaurant doing? Are you going to run for office? Have you seen the mayor lately?
Over the years, the people closest to Banks had learned that these questions, and especially his two best-known greetings,
are you married?
And
how's your wife?
Were a defense mechanism. As long as he was asking questions, he didn't have to answer them. He was widely hailed as baseball's greatest ambassador. He exuded happiness and insisted there was nothing he would rather do than play baseball. He never refused to give an interview or sign an autograph. And his signature line,
it's a beautiful day for a ball game. Let's play two.
Became a much quoted and much parodied part of the American vocabulary. But he would not talk about himself. But as the two men rode through the flat Midwestern landscape, Banks began to talk. And for the first time since Meravitz had known him, and the last, he talked about himself. He talked about growing up as the oldest boy in a family of 12 in Dallas and the responsibilities that entailed. Once, he had missed a year of school to help his father pick cotton. He talked about playing for the Kansas City Monarchs as the Negro Leagues were in their final years because the best young black players were following Jackie Robinson and the other pioneers into the major leagues. He talked about Buck O'Neill, Cool Papa Bell, and all the others who had missed their chance because they had been born too soon, and how they compensated by teaching those who came after everything they knew. He talked about the women in his life and the mistakes he had made with them, one after another. He talked about his distant relationship with his three children and how he wished he had been a better father. He talked about his teammates who had become as close as family during their playing days. He talked about Leo Durocher, who had humiliated and mocked him while Durocher was managing the Cubs, and how he had responded with silence and runs batted in. He talked about the piercing disappointment of the Cubs' fabled, faded season of 1969, when the city and its fans had been on fire until the all-too-bitter end. He talked about the pain of never having played in a World Series and the fear that he would be remembered more for that piece of bad luck than for the great player he had been. He talked about the pleasures and burdens of being the very symbol of his team, a one and only Mr. Cub.
Hey, hey, holy mackerel, no doubt about it, the Cubs are on their way. Hey, hey, hey! Let's do it again here. Get up a little bit. Put it back.
The hours rolled by, and Meravitz, fascinated by Banks's stories about himself, fascinated that Banks was telling stories about himself, glanced up and saw a sign that said, Clare City.
This doesn't seem right,
he thought. He had been distracted by Banks's monologue, he realized, and not paying attention to where they were going. He had better stop and check the directions he'd been given back at the hotel.
Chicago?
The man at the gas station said, and burst out laughing.
Ha! You came the wrong way, fella.
Meravitz had not driven east from Omaha toward Illinois, he was told, but north into South Dakota. He had driven through South Dakota, in fact, almost to the North Dakota border. The seven-hour trip he had planned would now take at least 14. Laughing at the absurdity of it all, he gave his passenger the bad news, turned the car around, and headed for home. Ernie Banks talking about himself all the while.
That's the prologue from Ron Rappaport's new biography of Ernie Banks. It's called Let's Play 2, The Legend of Mr. Cub, The Life of Ernie Banks, and it's available now. Many thanks to the talented actors who helped bring our double play to life. Amory Sievertson, Candace Springer, Alex Ashlock, Gary Wallach, Alex Schneps, and Kelvin Brooks. After he sang the national anthem at the 1968 World Series, Jose Feliciano heard some cheers.
But they were very sparse, and I heard a lot of boos. And I said, wow, what did I do? Why are they booing me, you know?
Coming up, how that performance changed Feliciano's life for better and for worse. And remember, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at OnlyAGameNPR.
Hey, it's Guy Raz here, host of the TED Radio Hour. And on our latest episode, we're exploring what it takes to create social change and the many ways that we as individuals might be able to make a difference in the world. Find it on the next TED Radio Hour from NPR.
I'm Karen Given. Next week on Only a Game, on the 25th anniversary of the Rwandan genocide, we meet a goalkeeper who was saved by soccer. But now Charlie Pierce is here with the week's news. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, Karen.
Magic Johnson resigned from the Lakers on Tuesday. He told reporters, quote, I was happier when I wasn't the president. It's really hard to argue with that logic, isn't it?
I think that can be said of a number of people, actually. All of them, not necessarily people who ran sports franchises. It's always good not to be the president.
Well, the Lakers brought in LeBron James this year after their fifth consecutive losing season, and then they had a sixth consecutive losing season. I know everyone loves Magic, but wasn't it his job to come up with a better plan than this?
Yeah. Bringing in LeBron, and this sounds very strange given the status of LeBron in the game, was a desperation move, and it didn't work. So it was time for Magic to step aside and, I guess, run the Dodgers, which is his other job.
Charlie, I'd like to present to you my submission for the hockeyest headline of the week. Are you ready?
Go.
Sharks Pavelski scores goal off jaw, loses teeth. Pretty good, eh?
Hey, I mean, that's a hockey guy, right? Did the biscuit go in the basket?
As long
as the biscuit went in the basket, it doesn't matter where it went first, including off your head.
The Sharks won the game, and Pavelski said, we earned that one, and that's a good feeling. I think he and I have different definitions of good feeling.
Yes, I think possibly the xylocaine was a good feeling there.
Virginia beat Texas Tech in overtime in the NCAA men's title game on Monday night, and almost immediately, one writer declared that the team had, quote, the most redemptive season in the history of college basketball. I don't want to take away from Virginia's win here, but that seems like a bit of an overstatement to me.
Yeah, there was a lot of hysterical reporting in that vein. You know, what they're talking about, of course, is Virginia bouncing back from having become the first number one seed to lose to a number 16 seed last year in University of Maryland, Baltimore County. people were behaving as though this is a Virginia team that, you know, recovered from a cholera outbreak aboard a plane that crashed. All they did was lose a bad game.
Well, and in case you're wondering how they managed to come back from such a terrible loss in just 388 days, someone actually counted, Cavs coach Tony Bennett apparently hired a lot of extra motivational speakers this year. So there's that.
Thank you for coming to my TED Talk, which is entitled, Don't Lose the 16th Seeds Again. Although I have to admit, the first round game, number one seeded Virginia fell 14 points behind 16th seeded Gardner-Webb. And everybody in the arena was holding their breath.
Well, 20,000 people were in the arena to watch the women's final, and they saw quite a game, right?
Terrific game. Baylor's a deserving national champion. I thought Notre Dame played an incredibly tough and smart and well-rounded game, and neither Connecticut nor Tennessee was in the finals.
Charlie, last week you issued this warning to those faced with damp baseball fields this spring.
Setting something on fire will dry it out, but it will turn it to ash. It's not terrific environmentally either, but the whole point is it's not going to achieve your primary purpose.
Seems like good advice to me, but apparently some folks in Connecticut weren't listening.
As they say in Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, I got vision and the rest of the world's wearing bifocals.
Apparently this time there were 15 to 20 parents who took turns dousing the baseball field with gasoline while at least 100 other people watched.
This goes past a well-intentioned but bad idea and into some sort of weird community activity. Did they open the concession stands? Because it sounds like a lot of people just showed up to watch.
And finally, Charlie, I can understand wanting to retire with some swagger, but Ignacio Barbagallo, an amateur soccer player from Sicily, took that to a new level when he hung him up last week.
Yeah, he had a fake terrorist group come down and abduct him. Which, by the way, if you lower a helicopter on top of your baseball field and just a little bit above the ground, it will dry it out without having to light it on fire. So next time, hire a helicopter. No, this was quite a performance. I'm staggered to imagine what, if this guy had actually been a high-level professional, what he would have actually done to announce his retirement.
I don't want to know.
I don't either, actually.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce at Sports Illustrated, and he joins us each week here at Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Karen.
On October 7th, 1968, more than 50,000 fans packed Tiger Stadium for Game 5 of the World Series between the Detroit Tigers and the St. Louis Cardinals. Before the first pitch, a 23-year-old singer named Jose Feliciano took the field to sing the national anthem. What happened next would change Feliciano's life for better and for worse. Reporter Roger Weber starts at the beginning.
Jose Feliciano's life began in Puerto Rico. Congenital glaucoma left him blind at birth. 5 years later, he moved with his family to New York City. He learned to play the accordion and then mastered a $10 Stella guitar.
To me, it meant everything because it took me a while to learn to play it because I taught myself.
How many hours a day would you spend practicing on that guitar?
14 hours. When I would get home from school, that's where I went, to the guitar immediately. And I tuned into American Bandstand, and I would play with whatever records they played at that time.
Jose started playing coffee houses in Greenwich Village, then clubs around the country. In 1968, he won 2 Grammys, and his version of The Doors' Light My Fire rocketed to number 3 on the charts. Come on, baby, light my fire. Try to set the night on fire. That year, he also caught the attention of someone in the Detroit Tigers organization.
Then I heard about this young Puerto Rican blind who had burst on the scene. He had a big hit.
That's the late Tigers announcer Ernie Harwell speaking in a 2009 video recorded by the Detroit Free Press. Harwell was an amateur songwriter, so Tigers general manager Jim Campbell had tasked him with recruiting anthem singers for the 3 World Series games in Detroit. For games 3 and 4, everything went according to plan. First, nightclub singer Margaret Whiting took the field. Then it was Motown star Marvin Gaye.
And it was a little ironic that Campbell went to me and said, "Now, would you please talk to Marvin and ask him not to give too much of a soul rendition?" So I did, and he said, "Yeah, I'll sing it straight."
Did Ernie Harwell ever ask you to sing the anthem straight?
No.
So
no.
You were free to do it the way you wanted.
Exactly. He never He didn't have a chance to talk to me, which I'm glad of. Because if I'm told not to do something, I'll do it anyway.
How much time did you have to work on your version of the anthem?
I had been working on a version of the anthem, at least a year before that. But it was totally radical and different than what I did. And I said, "Well, Jose, you know what? Maybe you shouldn't be so radical and do it a little bit easier for them to listen to and know that you weren't messing around with the anthem."
Feliciano walked with his service dog to center field, settled on a stool, and cradled his guitar.
I came out of nowhere, We weren't expecting anything different,
That's former Tigers pitcher John Hiller.
And we said, "Oh, my God, Ernie, what did you do?"
Fellow pitcher John Warden was standing near Hiller on the third baseline.
"Holy cow, what's that? What's he doing?" And everybody's looking around at each other, and you can hear the fans just sort of, you hear that background rumble.
Well, I heard some cheers, but they were very sparse, and I heard a lot of boos. And I said, "Wow, what did I do? Why are they booing me?"
When did you really get the idea that there was a controversy?
Well, when I went to my seat, because I watched a couple of innings. I had to head back to the airport and back to Las Vegas. I was thinking to myself, "Wow, what did I do?" And Tony Kubek, who was the broadcaster then, came to me and said, "You've caused some commotion here. The phones for NBC at the network have been ringing."
But some people in Detroit, like 14-year-old Susan O'Million, loved hearing a new sound for the same old anthem.
I was in class on the way home. I heard that something had happened at the ballpark, People were talking on the streets, on the porches along the way. When I got home, during the news, they showed a clip of this guy playing the guitar and singing the anthem as no one had ever heard. And it was like, wow, this is cool. There was so much negativity that I thought was unnecessary, uncalled for, unfair. I don't know, a 14-year-old, what do they do? Back in those days, if you're me, you start a fan club.
We'll get back to Susan O'Million later. Why did you sing the anthem the way you did?
Because I was sick and tired of hearing it the old way and the audience kind of not being into it. Get to the end of the song and the audience would start clapping as if to say, "Thank God this thing is passed." And I got tired of that. I did. I really, really did. And I said, "I'll fix it."
You sure did.
Well, it fixed me for a while. My records were stopped. People at radio stations stopped playing my records. They wanted to deport me, but you can't deport a citizen of the United States. But it was funny to me. I thought, where the hell am I going to go?
Fast forward 50 years to September 8th, 2018. Jose Feliciano was in Detroit to sing the anthem again at a Tigers reunion. Before going to the ballpark, he met fans in a crowded room at the Detroit Historical Museum. As Feliciano answered their questions, his wife sat in the front row.
She will think, of course, I'm crazy. Sometimes I know she thinks I'm lazy. But I do what I do. I do what I do, and everything I do, Susan, I do it for you.
Oh. And this is where we get back to that better and worse part. Because Susan, Susan O'Million, is the same Susan who started the fan club for Jose Feliciano back in 1968. She met Jose 3 years after his historic anthem performance in Detroit.
By the end of the week, he was having dinner at my house, and we went to Bobolo, and
The amusement park.
The amusement park. And my dad was in the hospital at the time, and so he wanted to visit him. So he brought a guitar and gave him a little concert at the hospital.
How long have you been married?
36 years. We married on our 11th anniversary of having become friends.
They have 3 children. And Feliciano rebounded after that 68 performance. His long career has produced 45 gold and platinum records. A few hours after his appearance at the museum, Feliciano arrived at Comerica Park. He walked to a stage near second base to perform before a Tigers regular season game against the Cardinals. He wore a Tigers jersey with Feliciano 68 on the back.
Oh, say, can you see by the dawn?
What was it like for you to see him perform the anthem again 50 years later?
Oh, my goodness. It was a really important moment because it defined his life in such a negative way for so long. It was magnificent. I wanted my town to let him know how they really felt, how we all as a people really feel. I think we've grown since 1968, and so we've gone full circle.
And the home. Of the brave. Hey, hey. I love you, Detroit.
The rendition was about the same as the performance from 50 years ago, but he wasn't using the guitar from 1968. It had been donated to the Smithsonian National Museum of American History a few months earlier. On that day, 20 people from 17 nations took the oath of citizenship.
Congratulations to each of you.
Feliciano gave the new Americans a message. It was in his heart long before his 1968 World Series performance.
I welcome you all with open arms, and this is America, and America will always be great because of the people that come to it and make their home here. Thank you so much and congratulations.
That story was written and narrated by Roger Weber and produced by Zach Rosen. A longer version aired on the podcast Mismatch. We'll have a link at onlyagame.org. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach, with help from Nico Emack and Matthew Stock. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our senior producer is me. I'm Karen Given. Only a Game returns next week. Thanks for listening.